Natural gas pipeline companies can use eminent domain to take land for new projects. And it's more than a headache for some landowners.
How can this be happening? I can't even tell you the amount of stress level, personally, that has been put us through.
I'm Carol Holzapfel. This week on the Allegheny Front, a maple farmer is stuck in the middle when state and federal regulators don't agree on pipeline permits. Plus, a look inside the Trump administration's strategy for environmental policy.
Deconstruction of the administrative state.
And a popular, pretty plant for garden borders is making things ugly for forests. Those and more environmental stories are coming up on the Allegheny Front. Stay with us. The State Department of Environmental Protection is reviewing a new plan by CONSOL Energy to mine beneath a stream inside a state park in Greene County. The Allegheny Front's Reed Frazier reports the plan proposes a new method to repair any damage to the stream caused by mining.
Last month, a panel of judges threw out a permit the DEP gave to CONSOL to mine beneath Poland Run, which runs through Ryerson Station State Park. The judges rejected CONSOL's contingency plan to rebuild the stream if its operations caused subsidence in the stream bed and a drop in stream flow. To comply with the ruling, the company says it will now use a spray-on polyurethane to seal any cracks it causes in the stream bed. CONSOL says it's laid off 300 miners while it waits for the DEP to rule on the plan. Former DEP Secretary John Quigley says the agency needs time to make sure the permit will pass legal muster.
So DEP has to do a tremendous amount of due diligence on any permit of this nature. And their challenge is compounded by the fact that the agency is very severely understaffed.
Quigley says recent court rulings mean the agency needs to take extra care in reviewing permits.
And because we're dealing with a longwall mine underneath a state park, there's an additional level of scrutiny and analysis that DEP is required to do before making a permit decision.
The company says it's in communication with Governor Tom Wolf's office and the DEP. The two environmental groups who have appealed CONSOL's permit to mine beneath the stream declined comment. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Reed Frazier.
For the past 32 years, Willie Nelson, along with Neil Young, John Mellencamp, and now Dave Matthews, have gathered with other musicians to throw a concert to raise money for family farms. It's Farm Aid.
Whiskey River, take my mind. Don't let her memory torture me.
I got an up close glimpse of the outside world. It's an awful big.
The artists come on their own dime and raise millions of dollars for farmers. Last weekend, the Allegheny Front got a special treat. Farm Aid hosted its annual benefit concert in Burgettstown, Pennsylvania, and the folks who run it invited us to moderate the discussions that take place throughout the day around farming issues. Reporter Julie Grant covers agriculture and food issues for the Allegheny Front, and she joins me now to talk about what a great time we had at Farm Aid and what we learned about the state of farms in our region. Hey, Julie.
Hi, Kara. So each year they hold a concert at a different location to make it easier for farmers in different areas to attend. A few days before this show in Western Pennsylvania, Carolyn Mugar, the executive director of Farm Aid, came to our studios, and I asked her why they came here this time.
Willie's answer is, well, we always want to go where we're wanted. And we feel extremely wanted here. It's a great example of how it is looking at where real jobs can be created and where real opportunities lie for people.
So tell me a little bit more about what she's talking about there.
Well, let's look back at Farm Aid when it first started. In 1985, U.S. farms were in the worst financial crisis since the Great Depression, and family farms were being auctioned off in large numbers. Willie Nelson and Bob Dylan were among those playing something called the Live Aid concert that year.
Oh, yeah, I remember Live Aid.
Bob Dylan said, "We should be doing something for American farmers." Willie heard it, picked it up, and said, yeah, we should, let's, and he did.
Mueger says Willie invited his musician friends to get together for a show, and they threw the first Farm Aid together in just a few weeks. These days, it's a much bigger production that takes months of planning.
Yeah, it's a huge deal. You know, the image of family farmers has kind of gotten a makeover since those days, but financially, many are still struggling to make ends meet, you know, in this sort of more corporate food environment.
All right, well, let's listen to what Willie Nelson had to say about that at a press conference held just before the concert.
32 years we've been doing this. And we'll do it another 32 if we have to. But we hope we don't have to. We hope that things are changing now and the farmers are moving along on their own pretty well. They figured out organic farming. They figured out farm to market.
Well, one well-known farmer in the region who was in the spotlight there at Farm Aid was Don Kretschmann. He got a lot of applause on stage for talking about how he became an organic farmer decades ago instead of becoming a physicist.
Yeah, that's what he said he trained for in college. Here he is on stage with Willie and the other Farm Aid musicians.
I love farming because I can do it exactly the way I want to, and I'll never have to be ashamed of what I've done.
I just want to say it's a great honor to be up here with these farmers. These people are great.
If you don't recognize that voice, it's Neil Young, and he had more on his mind about the state of the country.
America is already great. It's great. Okay? People, if you watch TV, you're going to feel bad. Because all they talk about is bad things. That's not what farming is about. Farming is about real people working together.
Farm Aid organizers said another reason they wanted to hold the show in this region is that not only are there a lot of rural farms, but there are also a good number of urban growers. Here's Ayanna Jones of Sankofa Village Community Garden in Pittsburgh, who was also featured in a special video at Farm Aid.
We're in a community right now where in 40 years hasn't been a grocery store. What is it, black people don't eat? And with that, we came up with food apartheid. And food apartheid is a conscious effort to deny people healthy food because you devalue them as human beings. We have to come to the table with a plan.
That was a really powerful moment at the press conference. Kara, you led some discussions in the afternoon of Farm Aid, including one farmer who's hoping to train people after they're released from the prison system.
Yeah, Josh Inklevich of Fit Farms in Pittsburgh. He's got a mission to ground people and teach them the skills to grow and cook food as they rejoin society and their families.
It's really to break that multi-generational cycle. You know, the parent goes to prison, chances are the child's going to prison too. So they're bringing what changed my life to other people.
Yeah, I was also really inspired by some of the artists. The Avett brothers sat on a panel I hosted about farm innovators.
Way to name drop, Julie.
They grew up... Gotta do it sometimes. Now, they grew up on what their website calls a hobby farm, but here's Scott Avett.
Hobby farm is loose because it wasn't really a pleasurable hobby as much as it was, this is a necessity that if you're going to think about what you need in case you have to rely on your own resources, what do you need?
The Avett brothers did not think farming was cool back then. They said they were called to make music, but now they understand better why farming can also be a higher calling.
I always say these farmers are the real rock stars of our country. And now for young people, there's really this road to being something very respectable and like a true hero. Like, you know, it's there. And it's really hip.
Yeah, Southeast Ohio farmer Kip Rondi really seemed to appreciate that message. But he also drove home how tough it can be to make a living running a family farm.
Yeah, he and his wife have figured out a system of high tunnels, and it helps them to grow vegetables year-round to sell locally. But then he told the crowd that was there to watch the Avett brothers and others on the panel that his farm needs stores like Whole Foods and Kroger to carry local produce.
And we need you all to say, doggone it, get some local stuff in here and push them. Please push them. Because you're not only helping yourselves, and your family, but you're helping your entire community, and we can change this that way.
So even though, as Willie Nelson mentioned, more people are seeking out local food, we heard from a lot of farmers like this that they feel like they're still up against a huge corporate food system, and there are so many things that can impact them.
Yeah, like the West Virginia couple that I talked with, they were nearly wiped out by a flash flood last summer. They were saved by money from a GoFundMe that was set up by their relatives, and they also got a small emergency grant from FarmAid.
Yeah, that's one of the things FarmAid has established through the years, a network of local organizations. They say they're working now to quickly assist farmers impacted by Hurricanes Harvey and Irma.
Well, there's a lot more about what we learned and experienced at FarmAid at our website, including some really great photos of the performers and the local rock star farmers. That's at AlleghenyFront.org. Julie Grant covers agriculture and food issues and all kinds of other things for the Allegheny Front. Thanks, Julie. Keep on rocking in the free world.
All right. Thanks, Kara. Thanks for a fun day.
This is the Allegheny Front. I'm Carol Holsapple.
And his subjects gathered round him like the leaves around a tree, and their clothes of many colors for the angry gods to see.
If you want to destroy your enemy, you have to know your enemy. For people trying to get rid of invasive Japanese barberry, that means recognizing the shrub's distinctive inner stems.
That's classic barberry. Bright, bright, bright yellow.
Coming up later on the Allegheny Front, the struggle to remove an invasive plant from Pennsylvania forests. And the struggle is real. Stay tuned. The federal government allows companies to take private land using eminent domain to build new natural gas pipelines. It's a scenario that's becoming increasingly familiar for Pennsylvania landowners. Take one family's ordeal in Susquehanna County, where property was cleared for a project that might never be built. State Impact Pennsylvania's Marie Cusick has more.
Last year, workers for one of the nation's largest natural gas pipeline companies cut down a large swath of maple trees in rural northeastern Pennsylvania. They were on a farm that's smack dab in the middle of the county. A video shot by an activist shows the trees crashing down as chainsaws buzz. Kathy Hollerin was powerless to stop it. She'd been using the trees for her family's maple syrup business, but the pipeline company condemned her land using the power of eminent domain.
That's the end. That's the south end of the property. This is going north.
Driving around a year and a half later, she's still in disbelief. A court order prevented her from interfering with the chainsaws, and law enforcement officers came to protect the pipeline workers.
So we had to stay completely away. That's when they brought the armed U.S. Marshals with assault rifles and the Pennsylvania State Police on either end of our road, and had guys walking all over our property with these assault rifles and bulletproof vests. I mean, really, what we're making, sir. What do you think we're going to do? Are we going to go attack these guys?
Walking through what's left, Hollerin finds tree stumps hidden beneath shoulder-high weeds.
But this used to all be woods. You can see, you know, as thick as that.
By her count, she lost more than 550 trees.
I went through with my camera and took pictures from every angle of all six piles and counted them by hand several times to be sure that I was accurate.
She says her family's maple syrup business has been cut in half. But the real shame of it all, Hollerin adds, is this may have all been for nothing. The so-called Constitution Pipeline was supposed to emanate from northeastern Pennsylvania and run more than 100 miles north through New York. Federal regulators gave their blessing to the project. So did Pennsylvania regulators. But New York State, which is about 20 miles away from Hollerin's farm, refused to grant a necessary water permit. The pipeline company, Williams, sued, but a federal court recently sided with New York.
All along we kept saying, you might not get through New York. You might not get your permits. Well, you're going to come through here and cut our land, which we asked you not to, which we begged you not to, which we did not sign. No compensation to date, not one penny. And
Nobody likes having their property taken by eminent domain, says Fred Lowther, a partner at the law firm Blank Rome. He's represented major oil and gas pipeline companies.
27 years ago, I was chief counsel for a project called the Iroquois Pipeline.
In that situation, he says a planned route wound up impacting a lot of celebrities' homes.
The opposition from property owners was intense. A public hearing in a high school. Arthur Miller came, Meryl Streep came, Dustin Hoffman came, Henry Kissinger came. I mean, it was an amazing show.
Despite the opposition, it was eventually built. It wasn't until about a decade ago, he says, that the industry ran into a bigger problem. A state was able to kill a federally approved pipeline. The so-called Islander East Project was supposed to run from Connecticut under Long Island Sound, but Connecticut wouldn't give it a water quality certificate, claiming it would damage nearly 600 acres of clam beds. And when the pipeline company sued, a federal court sided with the state.
And it caused quite a stir in the industry because the intention was not to give the states the veto power over a federally approved project, but to give them a say, you know, in how the project was shaped.
History appears to be repeating itself with the Constitution Pipeline. Lowther says pipeline companies will likely be more cautious about taking land and cutting down trees.
And I think going forward in the future with pipeline projects, people will be very careful before they authorize either the taking of land or the clearing of right-of-way.
It's long been assumed by the industry that once their projects get approval from the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, known as FERC, then the state permits will fall into place.
Historically, that has not been a problem.
Mark Robinson is a gas industry consultant who used to work at FERC.
So we're kind of in a new arena now. The rules of the game have changed a little bit.
Earlier this month, West Virginia environmental regulators moved to rescind a water certificate for another federally authorized natural gas pipeline. Robinson says states shouldn't have veto power over important interstate projects.
I would imagine you're going to see some significant pushback from the pipeline industry.
But landowners are also pushing back. Angela McGowan is an attorney in Harrisburg for the firm Pillar Ott. She's represented property owners dealing with new pipelines and says the industry generally has the upper hand. They just have to pay the people whose land they're taking.
Yeah, I mean, the eminent domain code essentially, either at the state and the federal level, basically just says that you've got to prove that you have the power. And once you do that, it's just about what the just compensation is.
But back on her farm, Kathy Holleran is still waiting for answers and compensation. She and the company are still in court, and they haven't agreed on how much she should be paid.
How can this be happening? How can that be possible? I can't even tell you the amount of stress level, personally, that has been put us through.
And so far, the conflicting decisions from the state of New York and the federal government have left her with heaps of rotting maple trees strewn across her property. Marie Cusick, State Impact, Pennsylvania, Susquehanna County.
The Trump administration came in with a philosophy, an agenda, which then Chief Strategist Steve Bannon laid out in February.
Deconstruction of the administrative state.
Basically, a sea change in how the previous administration ran things.
If you look at these cabinet appointees, they were selected for a reason, and that is the deconstruction. The way the progressive left runs is if they can't get it passed, they're just going to put it in some sort of regulation in an agency. That's all going to be deconstructed.
And since then, Trump's cabinet members have gotten down to business, including the rolling back of environmental protections on everything from chemical safety to flood protection. But there's only so much a president can do. What has President Trump actually accomplished in terms of reshaping environmental regulations? For our latest episode of the Trump on Earth podcast, the Allegheny Front's Reed Frazier spoke with a journalist who's been following this, Timothy Kama of The Hill.
I guess what I'd like to do is start with the Environmental Protection Agency and Scott Pruitt, the secretary of the agency. We've already seen him roll back or delay implementation for at least 30 rules and regulations. Can you lay out a general overview of what Scott Pruitt's EPA is trying to do and how it's gone about doing that?
Yeah, Reed. Well, you know, when you say 30 there, that
that caught me a bit by surprise almost. This has been one of the successful places in the Trump administration where, of the many promises that Trump has made in numerous policy and politics areas, we've seen a lot of problems. But with rolling back environmental regulations and taking down the sort of what the administration sees as impediments to the production and use of fossil fuels, the EPA is pretty much taken action on most of the major climate change initiatives that the President Obama did. The big one, of course, is the Clean Power Plan. And right now, EPA is working on that. There will probably be a proposal that will come out soon, a notice of proposed rulemaking that will be open to comment. So that's one of the things that we're waiting for. I'm personally looking at what rationale the EPA uses to say that this rule needs to be rolled back. You know, when they do this, they have to justify everything that they're doing pretty strongly, build a record, if you will, of why this is something that needs to happen. So they might say, for example, that the regulation is not compatible with the Clean Air Act. That was something that Scott Pruitt argued last year when he was Attorney General of Oklahoma. Another thing that I'm looking out closely for is if he will try to replace the Clean Power Plan with something else, some other policy to reduce carbon emissions from the power sector, which on the one hand would be a little bit surprising because he doesn't at all seem to think that that's something that then needs to be done. But he might look at it and see it as a way to protect against future lawsuits against the EPA to do something on carbon, probably in a much weaker way than the Clean Power Plan. The other big blockbuster from EPA is, of course, the Clean Water Rule.
It's a horrible, horrible rule. Has sort of a nice name, but everything else is bad. I've been hearing about it.
This is the rule, just to remind people, that kind of expanded the definition of a waterway or a body of water that was in the EPA's purview under the Clean Water Act.
Today, EPA is taking action to keep America's waters clean and healthy. For more than four decades.
In other words, they've already regulated what you can dump into big rivers, but this is moving further upstream into smaller waterways.
To be clear, it clarifies which waters are protected and which waters are not. It cuts red tape.
Since the Clean Water Act was first passed in the early 1970s, you know, it's been obvious that it applies to big things like the Chesapeake Bay or the Ohio River or the Gulf of Mexico. But there's always been a back and forth about how far upstream that goes. So this was another one where early on in the administration, Trump signed an executive order asking EPA to begin the process of reconsidering it. That is actually still open for the public comment period. And that proposal would literally just repeal the regulation. It would put the standards back in the form that they were before that regulation. This is one of those areas where Pruitt has stated, and the EPA has stated, that they want to replace it with some other kind of regulation. They feel that the previous regulation was still too uncertain, too wishy-washy. They want to write a new regulation. So that process has also started up.
U.S. Environmental Protection Agency Administrator Scott Pruitt, he's in Arkansas today, scheduled to talk about the Waters of the U.S. rule and how it's impacting farmers in the state. Good morning, Administrator.
Scott Pruitt, for example, during August went to many states to meet with governors and with farmers and others affected by this regulation to kind of start to get input on that.
Pretty busy. Tell us a little bit about what the administration wants to change about the 2015 Waters of the U.S. rule and what you guys are trying to explain.
These kind of rules impact states like Arkansas, farmers and ranchers very, very intensely because you have a Waters of the United States rule by the previous administration that defined those as puddles and dry creek beds, drainage ditches. So it impacts home builders, subdivisions. So we're here to visit with the governor and the attorney general to get that right.
But this whole process, of course, has a lot of opposition from environmentalists, from Democrats and others. You know, this rule really protected waterways that account for the drinking water for 117 million Americans. So pretty high stakes there. And they see this sort of as a direct attack on clean water and on protections for clean water. There's certain to be lawsuits on this at some point in the process. It's certain to take a long time.
Timothy Kamma covers energy and environment for The Hill. He spoke with the Allegheny Front's Reed Frazier for our Trump on Earth podcast. You can hear more at TrumpOnEarth.org or wherever you get your podcasts. Trump on Earth is a co-production with Point Park University's Environmental Journalism Program. That's TrumpOnEarth.org. Pennsylvania's forests are under attack from pests like hemlock woolly adelgid and emerald ash borer, and from invasive plants, including one you might even find in your own front yard. I spoke with some scientists about an all-too-common shrub that's bad news for the health of forests and people, too. It would definitely be an understatement to say that Ryan Utes is not a fan of Japanese barberry.
This is what we call barberry hell. That's going to be all that you see.
Utes is a professor at Chatham University's Falk School of Sustainability, and we're walking through some damp, forested land on the property of their Eden Hall campus north of Pittsburgh. He has some other choice words for the thorny, shoulder-high shrubs all along the tree line. He calls them insidious and alarming. That's because of what's beyond the wall of barberry.
We have a nice population of mature oaks, cherries, and red maples here, but based on our research, everywhere you see barberry, which, as you can see right now, is pretty much everywhere, there are no young trees underneath it.
Utes and some of his students, like Art Link, have noticed that even a small patch of Japanese barberry can inhibit new generations of native trees.
Barberry grows very thick and very dense, and because of that, it can limit a lot of the resource of sunlight.
But barberry doesn't mind the shade. It's also not popular with deer grazing in woodlands, and it's not easy to get rid of. Japanese barberry was introduced from Asia as an ornamental. It has pretty spoon-shaped red leaves and berries. Seeds from the berries are dropped onto the forest floor or spread by birds. Weedy shoots of barberry can also root themselves into the ground, starting new plants. Young barberry is pulled out easily, but in their study plots, Utes and Link are dealing with more established, stubborn patches like this one, and they're using some barberry-busting tools you can buy at any home improvement store. Utes slices through the barberry stems with hedge trimmers, getting as close to the ground as possible.
See that yellow stem material? That's classic barberry. Bright, bright, bright yellow.
Then Art Link hooks up a propane tank, like the one on your backyard grill, to a small torch.
What I like to do is actually go around and get a 360 burn.
He slowly incinerates the cluster of barberry stems.
Usually I listen to music, and whenever the chorus comes on, I know when 30 seconds is up.
The plant smolders, but Link says he'll have to do it again. Barberry has been known to grow back even after it's been torched. So just how big a problem is barberry in Pennsylvania's forests?
It's quite a large problem, actually.
Kelly Sitch is an ecologist with the Pennsylvania Bureau of Forestry. He says not only does barberry muscle out native tree species, but it also makes an ideal home for mice, and by extension, the deer ticks they host, the ones that carry Lyme disease.
So in areas where barberry remains uncontrolled, researchers have found that the incidence of ticks per acre that are infected with Lyme disease is actually much higher than in areas where it's being controlled or where it's not present.
Sitch says each year, the state's foresters and biologists prioritize sections of land that are inundated with invasive species. And sometimes barberry makes it to the top of that list. They can use a combination of pulling it out mechanically if it doesn't disturb the soil too much, or scatter seeds, or apply herbicides to keep barberry from spreading. But Sitch agrees with Ryan Utes from Chatham when it comes to the best way to keep Japanese barberry out of Pennsylvania's forests.
Please don't buy barberry.
The Japanese variety, anyway. Although it's been banned in some states, many nurseries and big box stores still sell it for landscaping in Pennsylvania. Utes says there are other non-invasive species of barberry available, and he's a lot less prickly about those. You might want to pay close attention for your fall plantings. There's more at AlleghenyFront.org. Thanks for listening to this week's show. We're also on Facebook and Twitter at Allegheny Front. Kathy Naur is the executive producer of the Allegheny Front. I'm Carol Holsoppel.
Support for the Allegheny Front comes from the Heinz Endowments and the Park Foundation. The Richard King Mellon Foundation supports our coverage of conservation. State Impact Pennsylvania is a collaboration between public radio stations WITF in Harrisburg and WHYY in Philadelphia, covering the Commonwealth's energy economy.